Friedrich Nietzsche's life reached a dramatic climax on a cold January day in 1889. In the Piazza Carlo Alberto in Turin, Italy, the 44-year-old philosopher witnessed a coachman savagely whipping a horse that refused to move. Nietzsche ran forward and threw his arms around the exhausted animal's neck, bursting into tears. He then collapsed to the ground. Soon after this incident, Nietzsche sent frantic letters, signing them as Dionysus, or the Crucified, to friends and even to the German Kaiser, making grandiose statements. His brilliant mind had shattered. The author of Thus Spoke Zarathustra and Beyond Good and Evil, who declared the death of God and foresaw the rise of nihilism, descended into madness. He would never regain his lucidity. This poignant episode in Turin symbolizes the tragic arc of Nietzsche's life, a story of staggering intellectual brilliance, chronic illness, intense personal conflict, and final collapse. In what follows, we will explore Nietzsche's philosophy and life in tandem, his key ideas and writings alongside the physical and psychological struggles that shaped them. Nietzsche's major contributions to thought, the concepts of the will to power, eternal recurrence, the Übermensch, a radical critique of morality and religion, and perspectivism, will be examined in context. We will see how these ideas emerged from Nietzsche's own experiences and conflicts, such as his friendship-turned-feud with composer Richard Wagner, his unrequited love for Lou Salome, and his feeling of isolation as a visionary largely unrecognized in his time. Nietzsche's life was short. He died at 55, and often lonely, racked by pain, but it was intellectually incandescent. Understanding the interweaving of his philosophy with his life not only paints a fuller portrait of this tragic genius, it also adds depth and nuance to his provocative ideas. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche was born on October 15, 1844, in the small village of Rucken in Saxony, Prussia, now part of Germany. He was born into a devoutly Christian family. His father was a Lutheran pastor, and the family's values were pious and traditional. Nietzsche's father died when Friedrich was only 5 years old, and he was raised in a household dominated by women, his mother Franziska, his younger sister Elizabeth, and their grandmother. The young Nietzsche was a serious, precocious child. Surrounded by religious devotion, he initially expected to follow in his father's clerical footsteps, but his intellectual destiny would soon diverge dramatically from his Christian upbringing. As a teenager, Nietzsche attended the prestigious boarding school Schulpforta, where he received a rigorous classical education, excelling especially in languages and literature. He went on to study philology, the study of classical languages and texts, at the University of Bonn and then Leipzig. By his late teens, Nietzsche had already encountered the writings of Arthur Schopenhauer, the pessimistic philosopher who described life as driven by a blind, ceaseless will to live. Schopenhauer's dark vision and atheistic stance made a deep impression on Nietzsche, who by this time had lost his childhood Christian faith. Another formative influence was music, particularly the operas of Richard Wagner, which Nietzsche adored in his youth. These influences primed Nietzsche to seek a new philosophical path emphasizing art, passion, and the meaning of existence in a godless world. In 1869, at the young age of 24, Nietzsche was appointed a professor of classical philology at the University of Basel in Switzerland. He had not even completed his doctorate when Basil recognized his talent and offered him the position. He gladly accepted, effectively leaving Prussian citizenship to live and work in Switzerland. He would remain officially stateless for the rest of his life. As a Basel professor, Nietzsche continued his close friendship with Richard Wagner, who was living nearby at Tribschen and was a frequent guest at Wagner's home. Nietzsche saw Wagner not just as a friend, but almost as a cultural savior, a composer who might revolutionize German art. Under these influences, Nietzsche wrote his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, 1872, a work that was part classical scholarship and part bold philosophy. In it, Nietzsche introduced a distinction between the Apollonian and Dionysian artistic drives, using Greek tragedy as his example. The Apollonian represents order, reason, harmony, and visual beauty embodied by the sun god Apollo, while the Dionysian represents chaos, passion, ecstasy, and music, embodied by Dionysus, the wine god. Nietzsche argued that the greatness of Greek tragedy came from blending these two forces. This was more than literary theory. Nietzsche was hinting at a view of life that honors both rational structure and irrational vitality. and that modern Western culture had become too Apollonian, too rationalistic and restrained, and had repressed the Dionysian zest for life. The Birth of Tragedy was not well received by academic philologists, who didn't appreciate its attacks on Socratic rationalism and its Wagnerian fervor, but it planted the seeds of Nietzsche's later philosophy, a celebration of life's creative energies and a critique of excessive rationality and moralism. Nietzsche was plagued by ill health from his youth, suffering migraines, severe eye problems, he was nearly blind without thick glasses, and digestive ailments. Modern scholars have debated the root cause. Suggestions range from migraine and bipolar disorder to an undiagnosed brain condition, or the effects of syphilis that he might have contracted in his student years. Whatever the cause, by his mid-30s, Nietzsche's health had deteriorated so much that he resigned his professorship in 1879, after a decade at Basel. He received a modest pension for his service, which, supplemented by small royalties and help from friends, allowed him to live extremely frugally. Thus began Nietzsche's life as an itinerant, independent philosopher, a period he called meskhen, a Persian word for a humble wanderer. For the next 10 years, 1879 to 1888, Nietzsche had no fixed home. He roamed through Europe, seeking climates that might alleviate his ailments. Summers in the cool alpine air of Sils Maria in Switzerland, winters in the milder towns of Italy, Genoa, Rapallo, Turin, or the French Riviera, he would often stay in boarding houses or modest rented rooms, alone with his books and thoughts. He carried with him a sense of purpose and urgency. He felt he had philosophic revelations to deliver to a largely unhearing world. In these wandering years, despite physical pain and loneliness, Nietzsche produced one groundbreaking work after another, writing with feverish intensity in a distinctive aphoristic style. Yet this productive solitude was not free from personal turmoil. Nietzsche's relationships were unraveling during the early 1880s. His friendship with Wagner, once like a disciple to a mentor, had collapsed. Nietzsche had broken with Wagner around 1876 to 1878 for both philosophical and personal reasons. Wagner's later operas, especially Parsifal, had taken on Christian themes that Nietzsche viewed as a betrayal of Wagner's earlier Dionysian spirit. Worse, Wagner had aligned himself with German nationalism and anti-Semitic circles, a stance Nietzsche found repugnant. Nietzsche's own writing, Human, All Too Human, in 1878, contained veiled barbs at Wagner's cultural hero pretensions, and by the early 1880s, they were publicly estranged. Wagner died in 1883 without reconciling with Nietzsche. His heartbreak over losing Wagner's friendship is often cited as a factor in the stark turn his philosophy took in the 1880s, away from romantic German idealism and toward a more radical reevaluation of all values. Another painful episode came in 1882 through Lou Andrea Salome, a brilliant 21-year-old Russian woman. Nietzsche met Salome in Rome through mutual friends. He was instantly enchanted by Lou's intellect and free spirit. They formed an ambitious plan for an intellectual commune of free thinkers living, studying, and writing together. Nietzsche, who had very little romantic experience, likely fell deeply in love with Salome. He proposed marriage to her. Some accounts say he even asked his friend Rie to propose on his behalf as a mediator, but Salome tactfully refused. She was not interested in marriage, and certainly not to a sickly man almost twice her age. The situation was complex. Rie himself was in love with Salome as well, and Nietzsche's sister Elizabeth, who disliked Salome, interfered with intrigues. In May 1882, the three posed for a now-famous photograph. Salome sits in a cart holding a whip, while Nietzsche and Rie are hitched to the cart, like beasts of burden. The playful scene, likely orchestrated by Nietzsche himself, metaphorically captured Nietzsche's sense of being dominated by his infatuation. Shortly thereafter, the tensions boiled over. Nietzsche felt betrayed by Salome and Rie's closeness, suspecting they were lovers, and by his sister's meddling. By early 1883, this unholy trinity had Nietzsche ended his friendship with Rie and Salome, plunging into an even deeper loneliness. Later, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche would famously write, "You go to women? Do not forget the whip." A line often criticized as misogynistic, but one that reflects the bitterness of this episode. Salome herself believed Nietzsche never recovered emotionally from this rejection. Amidst this personal chaos, Nietzsche wrote one of his greatest works. In just 10 days of frenzied inspiration in early 1883, while living in Rapallo, Italy, Nietzsche penned part one of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. This poetic philosophical text would eventually span four parts and contains many of Nietzsche's signature ideas. It is as if, having severed his remaining personal ties, Nietzsche poured all his yearning, vision, and pain into Zarathustra. The book's protagonist is a wandering prophet, Zarathustra, who comes down from the mountains to preach a new doctrine to humanity. Through Zarathustra's sermons and parables, Nietzsche introduced concepts like the Übermensch and the eternal recurrence, which we will discuss in detail shortly. Zarathustra also exalts the value of solitude and self-overcoming, clearly echoing Nietzsche's own situation. Nietzsche's life in the mid-1880s settled into a pattern of solitary work, punctuated by fierce bursts of creativity and debilitating bouts of illness. He often wrote in aphorisms, concentrated, standalone paragraphs of insight, because prolonged systematic writing was taxing on his health and eyesight. In 1885, he printed only 40 copies of the fourth part of Zarathustra and distributed few of Aware that almost no one was ready to hear his gospel. Nietzsche's works sold poorly and drew little attention in his lifetime. This lack of recognition weighed on him. He longed for readers who could understand him, yet he also took pride in being ahead of his time. "One is rewarded badly for being an Erkener, a knower of today," he wrote, likening himself to a man born posthumously. Despite the discouragement, Nietzsche did not relent. He continued to refine and amplify his critique of traditional morality and religion in books like Beyond Good and Evil, 1886, and On the Genealogy of Morals, 1887. These works analyzed the history and psychology of moral values, advancing Nietzsche's provocative thesis that modern Christian morality grew out of a slave revolt, an uprising of the weak to enchain humanity. It's noteworthy that during this period, Nietzsche made a decisive break with his publisher because the publisher had anti-Semitic leanings that Nietzsche detested. He took the bold step of publishing Beyond Good and Evil at his own expense in 1886, rather than be associated with anti-Jewish sentiments. Nietzsche's personal stance was strongly anti-Semitic. He despised the rising tide of German nationalism and Jew hatred in the 1880s. In a letter, he mocked his sister Elizabeth's husband as an anti-Semitic agitator. This moral courage would be cruelly twisted after his death. As we'll see, Nietzsche's sister later misrepresented him as a proto-Nazi, but the reality is Nietzsche regarded anti-Semitic nationalists as intellectually and morally contemptible. By 1888, Nietzsche's output reached a manic crescendo. Although still plagued by illness, he experienced a surge of energy and optimism, believing that the world was finally beginning to recognize his ideas. In this single year, his last year of sanity, Nietzsche wrote a flurry of books: The Case of Wagner, Twilight of the Idols, The Antichrist, Ecce Homo, his self-aggrandizing autobiography. He also planned a major work titled The Will to Power, Revaluation of All Values, which he never, it existed only as notebooks of drafts. After his breakdown, his sister would unscrupulously publish a distorted compilation of these notes. In late 1888, Nietzsche indulged in unprecedented self-praise and humor, with chapter titles like Why I Am So Wise and Why I Write Such Good Books. He seemed acutely aware that he was a destiny, a thinker whose time would come later. In the preface of Ecce Homo, he warns, "Hear me, above all, do not mistake me for someone reflecting his fear of being misunderstood." Tragically, within weeks of writing those words, Nietzsche's own mind would betray him. In early January 1889, just after sending off the manuscript of Ecce Homo, Nietzsche experienced a complete mental breakdown on the streets of Turin, the horse incident described in the introduction. After Nietzsche collapsed, two policemen took the incoherent man back to his boarding. Word reached his friends, and his old university colleague, Franz Overbeck, rushed to Italy. Nietzsche was soon transferred to a psychiatric clinic in Basel, and then to a clinic in Jena, Germany, under the care of Dr. Otto. The initial diagnosis was tertiary syphilis, a common 19th-century explanation for dementia in relatively young men. Modern analyses have questioned this, suggestions range from a hereditary brain disease to frontotemporal dementia or even a slow-growing tumor. But in 1889, whatever the precise medical cause, Nietzsche was deemed incurably insane. He was just 44. Nietzsche would live 11 more years in this incapacitated state, a cruel coda to his life. In 1890, his devout mother, Franziska, brought him home to Naumburg and cared for him. Nietzsche, once the fiery author who extolled strength and vitality, was now largely mute, prone to brief flashes of song or vacant laughter, but mostly lost in dementia. In 1893, after the death of their mother, Nietzsche's sister, Elisabeth Förster Nietzsche, took charge of him. She established the Nietzsche Archive, effectively becoming the gatekeeper of his literary estate. Visitors, from curious admirers to important intellectuals, would come to see Nietzsche, only to find a gaunt, mustachioed figure sitting weightlessly in a chair or staring blankly ahead while his sister spoke for him. One visitor in 1897, the budding psychologist Rudolf Steiner, tried to engage Nietzsche or read to him, but found it was impossible to teach her, Elizabeth, anything about philosophy or to get any response from Nietzsche. He had become a living statue. Elizabeth, who was an avowed German nationalist and anti-Semite, began curating Nietzsche's unpublished notes and letters to present him as a prophet of the far right. She selectively edited, and in some cases forged, Nietzsche's writings. In 1895, she compiled The Will to Power from his notebooks and published it, claiming it as Nietzsche's magnum opus. Scholars later showed that this book was assembled out of context and heavily manipulated by Elizabeth. The damage, however, was done. In the following decades, especially after Nietzsche's death in 1900, Elizabeth successfully promoted Nietzsche as a German nationalist icon. She even welcomed Adolf Hitler to the Nietzsche Archive in the 1930s, gifting Hitler Nietzsche's walking stick in a publicity stunt. The Nazi regime happily appropriated catchphrases like will to power and Übermensch for its propaganda, completely distorting Nietzsche's intent. Nietzsche, who had detested anti-Semitism and militaristic nationalism, was posthumously miscast as a Nazi thinker, a bitter historical irony. It was only after World War II, thanks to scrupulous scholarship, for example, by Walter Kaufmann in the 1950s, that Nietzsche's reputation was rescued from this misappropriation. Scholars showed that Nietzsche praised individual Jews, criticized the anti-Semitic movement, and reviled German chauvinism. The monstrous uses of his ideas by others were rooted in misunderstanding or willful misuse. In 1899, a decade after his collapse, in the care of his sister Elizabeth, reduced to a mute invalid, he was by then only a spectator to his growing fame. On August 25, 1900, Friedrich Nietzsche died in Weimar at age 55. The official cause was pneumonia and strokes, complications that followed years of paralysis and mental illness. His body was buried in his hometown of Röcken, beside his father's. At the moment of Nietzsche's death, his published works were still not widely read. Yet, like a seed waiting for the right soil, Nietzsche's ideas would soon sprout mightily in the 20th century, profoundly influencing philosophy, literature, psychology, and culture at large. Nietzsche was not a philosopher in the traditional academic mold. He wrote no systematic treatises. Instead, his philosophy is spread across aphorisms, parables, and passionate polemics, often in an unsystematic, literary style. However, there are several central ideas that Nietzsche continually developed. Understanding these key concepts is essential to grasp his impact. Each idea is best understood against the background of Nietzsche's personal journey we've traced. Nietzsche's major philosophical contributions are intertwined with the life experiences that informed them, in God is Dead and The Crisis of Nihilism. This dramatic pronouncement first appeared in The Gay Science, 1882, and recurs in Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Nietzsche did not mean that God literally lived and died. He meant that belief in the Christian God had ceased to be credible for many in Europe. The Enlightenment and modern science had, in effect, killed the traditional God by showing that the universe could be explained without the divine. Yet Nietzsche observed that Europeans had not yet fully grasped the consequences of this cultural death of God. Without the anchor of religious belief, the foundations of morality, value, and meaning, Nietzsche feared this would usher in nihilism, the belief that life has no inherent meaning or value. he describes modern nihilism as the looming sense that nothing has any inherent importance and that life lacks meaning. In his famous parable of the madman, Nietzsche writes of a man proclaiming God's death in a marketplace, only to be met with incomprehension, a metaphor for society's blindness to its own existential crisis. Nietzsche took nihilism very personally, calling it a guest that has come to stay with me, the deepest problem of his. Yet rather than simply bemoan this, Nietzsche also saw an opportunity. "I praise, I do not reproach, nihilism's arrival," he wrote, regarding it as a great test of humanity. The collapse of old values could lead either to despair or to liberation, depending on whether new values could be created to replace the old. Nietzsche's life experience. Losing his own faith, witnessing the complacency of 19th-century society, fueled his acute understanding of nihilism. He felt it in his bones, but also resolved to overcome it. No aspect of Nietzsche's thought is more provocative than his genealogical critique of Judeo-Christian morality. In Beyond Good and Evil and On the Genealogy of Morals, Nietzsche argues that our concepts of good and evil are not timeless truths, but rather human creations born from historical power. He distinguishes between master morality and slave morality. In ancient aristocratic societies, Nietzsche gives the example of Homeric Greece. Good essentially meant noble, strong, and life-affirming, the qualities of the rulers. Bad meant lowly, weak, and despicable, the condition of the enslaved. This was master morality, a value system originating from those in power, celebrating their own virtues, pride, strength, bravery, health, wealth. But as Nietzsche tells the story, the downtrodden people, especially in late antiquity, among the Jews and then early Christians, resented the nobles. Out of resentment, a deep-seated resentment that seeks revenge through value. Inversion, the weak developed slave morality. Slave morality said, "No, you arrogant masters are the evil ones. Humility, meekness, sympathy, those are truly good. Qualities that were powerless by master standards, meekness, poverty, chastity, were rebranded as moral virtues, while the former virtues, strength, pride, sensuality, were condemned as Nietzsche chillingly calls this, the slave revolt in morality, accomplished historically by the Judeo-Christian influence. This overturning made pity and equality the central virtues of Western morality, a move Nietzsche believed carried a hidden vindictiveness of the weak. Nietzsche's own experience of illness and weakness gave him a personal perspective on this moral inversion. He, a sickly man, could have easily adopted the comfort of a morality that made a virtue of weakness. But instead, Nietzsche despised his own weakness and refused to surrender to it. He often extolled hardness, risk, and struggle, masterful qualities, even as he personally suffered. This gives a biographical poignancy to his philosophical call for a revaluation of all values, a courageous scrutiny and overturning of inherited morals. Nietzsche wanted humanity to move beyond good and evil, by which he meant beyond the simplistic dichotomy that arose from slave morality. This does not mean beyond true and false, or an endorsement of atrocity, as some critics charged. Rather, Nietzsche hoped for individuals who could create new values rooted in life and strength, not in fear and resentment. He admired, for instance, the Renaissance aristocratic ethos and the pagan virtues of creativity and courage. He believed morality is a symptom, an expression of the psychological needs of its creators. Thus, we should examine who benefits from a given morality. His own writings often encourage exceptional individuals to become who you are. A favorite motto he took from the poet, unashamed of their superiority, rather than adhere to a morality for all that might stunt. As Nietzsche scholar Walter Kaufmann emphasized, Nietzsche was not simply cheering for historical masters over slaves. He was analyzing how moral values evolve, not advocating. Nietzsche acknowledged that what he called slave morality brought gentler values that helped ease existence for the masses. But his concern was that by the 19th century, those values had become life-denying and hypocritical, contributing to nihilism. The revaluation of values he sought was a restoration of honesty about our drives and the embrace of values that affirm life, strength, and creativity. Perhaps the most central and most misunderstood concept in Nietzsche's late philosophy is the will to power. By this, Nietzsche did not mean a conscious lust for political domination, but rather a fundamental drive that he believed underlies all life. In contrast to Schopenhauer's will to live, which was just a blind urge for survival, Nietzsche's will to power is a will to expand, to grow, to overcome obstacles and assert one's existence. Exploitation and striving are not evils in Nietzsche's view. They are natural features of life. From the amoeba pushing out pseudopods to the artist creating a masterpiece, each manifests a will to power. Nietzsche's concept is not crudely about physical or tyrannical power over others. It can manifest in self-mastery, in creative achievement, in risk-taking and self-overcoming. For instance, when an athlete breaks a personal record or a scientist presses into unknown theory, that is the will to power in action, the exhilaration of overcoming one's limits. Nietzsche wrote that happiness comes as the feeling of power is growing. This was a subtle rebuke to utilitarian philosophers who defined human motivation in terms of seeking pleasure or avoiding pain. Nietzsche saw the pursuit of mere comfort or happiness as something for the English shopkeeper. Deriding the utilitarians of true fulfillment, he argued, lies in pursuing one's goals and affirming one's strengths, even if that involves struggle. One can see Nietzsche's will to power as both descriptive, a theory of what life is, and prescriptive, an attitude to adopt. In his own life, Nietzsche exemplified a kind of will to power by continuing to think and write in spite of excruciating health problems and social isolation. He channeled his suffering into an intellectual triumph, which is perhaps why the concept of will to power resonated so deeply with him personally. It should be noted that Nietzsche initially planned a book titled Will to Power, but as mentioned, it remained incomplete. He did make tantalizing suggestions that the will to power might be more than a metaphor, perhaps a literal principle of nature, a replacement for force or energy in physics. But he never fully published such claims. Nietzsche even instructed that many of his notes be destroyed in 1888, sensing perhaps that they would be misused. Will to power means life is self-overcoming. This idea was later tragically twisted by Nazi ideologues into a jackboot ethic of domination, a distortion Nietzsche would have spat upon. But in Nietzsche's own context, it was as much about self-transcendence and creativity as anything else. For Nietzsche, the will to power is the answer to nihilism. If life has no preset meaning, we impose meaning through our will and creative power. In Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche introduced the figure of the Übermensch, literally, overman or superman. The German Über means beyond or above. This concept has been subject to wild misinterpretations. In Zarathustra, the prophet character proclaims, "Man is something that shall be overcome. What have you done to overcome him?" The Übermensch is presented as an ideal for humanity to aspire to after the death of God and the collapse of old mankind. It is not a specific person, but rather a vision of humanity's potential evolution, a future stage of being that creates new values and affirms life joyously and courageously. Nietzsche imagines the Übermensch as far beyond present humans as we are beyond apes. Zarathustra contrasts the Übermensch with the last man, a complacent, herd-like figure who just wants comfort and safety, having no ambition. Nietzsche worried that modern society was tending toward this last man, an age of mediocrity and nihilism where people avoid challenge and creativity. The Übermensch, by contrast, embraces danger and overcomes nihilism by creating new meaning. He, or she, nothing in the concept is inherently gendered, lives by a higher mode of existence, beyond conventional notions of good and evil, because he creates his own values rooted in life. Nietzsche intended this idea as inspiring and challenging, not as a blueprint for eugenics or a master race, distortions that came later. In fact, Nietzsche would have loathed the Nazi claim that Aryans were some kind of Übermensch. His Übermensch was a spiritual ethical ideal, not a racial one. Nietzsche's break with Wagner and disgust for nationalism reinforces this. He clearly did not equate greatness with German blood or anything so base. The tragic irony is that Nietzsche himself did not live to become anything like an Übermensch. Instead, he descended into the helplessness of mental illness, his idea of the Übermensch stands as a challenge. Can we uplift ourselves and our species to a higher mode of being? Now that the old gods have failed us, Zarathustra's answer is hopeful, urging a spiritual evolution. The Übermensch, in effect, is Nietzsche's answer to the void of nihilism, an antidote that requires great health, courage, love of life, and creativity. Among Nietzsche's boldest thought experiments is the idea of eternal recurrence. He asks, what if one day, or night, a demon were to come after you into your loneliest loneliness, and say, this life, as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more. This appears in the Gay Science, text 341, and is dramatized in Zarathustra. The concept has two layers. On the surface, it is a cosmological hypothesis that time is cyclical and everything repeats eternally. Every event that has happened will happen again and again. Nietzsche presents it almost like a mythic or poetic idea rather than a literal scientific claim, though he did toy with pseudoscientific arguments for it. More importantly, Nietzsche uses eternal recurrence as an ethical test. He challenges us. If you thought you had to live your exact life over and over for eternity, how would that prospect make you feel?